Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Friday, the 30th of August, these are our main stories. President Trump has established a new military command for space warfare, saying America's adversaries are weaponizing Earth's orbit and threatening its vital interests. Britain's opposition leader says MPs will try to reverse the government's decision to suspend Parliament and prevent a no-deal Brexit when the House returns next week. Also in this podcast...
These are two elements of what are supposed to be a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, who are now fighting each other heavily to the east of the city of Aden.
Why the Yemeni government is accusing its supposed allies of bombing its troops, and why there's no such thing as a single gay gene. Could space become a future battleground between the major powers here on Earth? Well, in the last few hours, President Donald Trump launched a new Pentagon command dedicated to warfare in space.
Just as we have recognized land, air, sea, and cyber as vital warfighting domains, we will now treat space as an independent region overseen by a new, unified geographic combatant command. The establishment of the 11th Combatant Command is a landmark moment. This is a landmark day, one that recognizes the centrality of space to America's national security and defense.
I found out more from our correspondent Peter Bowes in Los Angeles.
President Trump's vision is clearly for a space force, which is a new military branch. It will defend, he says, American interests in outer space, the next war-fighting domain, as he put it. The plan is to create a force which will be separate but equal to the U.S. Air Force, the other U.S. military branches being the Army, Navy, Coast Guard and Marine Corps. The Space Command, or SpaceCom as it's being called, will be run by a four-star general. It'll draw its forces from the other armed services, although those precise details are still to be revealed, and it still requires congressional approval. But essentially, its role will be to oversee all U.S. military and intelligence efforts in space, defending American satellites, supporting American troops from orbit, and planning how future combat might be conducted from space.
Yes, and he said America's adversaries were weaponizing Earth's orbit. So is that the perceived threat?
Yes, the perceived threat is from new technology. And as the president put it, the danger to the United States constantly evolve. And he said, so must we. And he points to threats from China and Russia developing counter space weapons designed to specifically attack satellites, threatening America's reliance on these satellites for defense operations. And he said he wanted to make sure that American satellites were not sitting ducks in this new sphere of potential conflict.
Yes, but there's a feeling of back to the future about this, because this isn't the first time the U.S. has looked at space as a future battleground, is it?
Yeah, it isn't new. The U.S. military used to have a space command. It was established in 1985 when there was a similar focus then put on preparing for potential wars in space. It was established by the Air Force to coordinate missile defense and surveillance efforts at a time when the Cold War was really heating up again. But then came September the 11th and the attacks on that day. And from that point, the U.S. refocused on fighting terrorism.
Peter Bowes. Now to the row over the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to seek the suspension of the UK's Parliament for 5 weeks, which shows no signs of abating. The main opposition Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, says plans are well underway by a cross-party group of MPs to stop the Prime Minister forcing a no-deal Brexit through Parliament.
What we're going to do is try to politically stop him on Tuesday with a parliamentary process in order to legislate to prevent a no-deal Brexit, and also to try and prevent him shutting down Parliament during this utterly crucial period. The implications for this country are very, very serious.
For his part, Cabinet Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg described the anger as a confection of candy floss and said that there was ample time for Parliament to discuss Brexit. And his fellow Conservative MP, Mark Francois, also dismissed the outrage as complete nonsense.
The reason I think that the Remainers are reacting like this is because they've begun to realise, finally, we are actually leaving. And these people are screaming blue murder because that's not what they want.
I discussed these heated exchanges with our political correspondent at Westminster, Susan Hulme.
No one's calmed down on this. And as you hear there, supporters of the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, have been out in force to attack the claims that he's trampling all over the UK's actually rather delicately balanced unwritten constitution. But of course, opponents fear this suspension of Parliament leaves them no time at all to seize control and stop the very possibility of leaving with no deal at the end of October.
And they're not limiting their efforts simply to Parliament, are they? They have also taken this, in some cases, to court. There's specifically a case at the Court of Session in Edinburgh in Scotland they're looking at as something that might produce a result they'd like.
This started a while back and they've been seeking what's called an interim interdict to stop Parliament being suspended with a full hearing next week on September the 6th. I mean, it's all very difficult constitutional ground because the Queen has already granted the suspension, but it's the advice on what she did that which is being challenged in the court, and the judge, Lord Doherty, has retired to think about his decision overnight.
And there's a great deal of opposition as well within the Conservative ranks, including some former government ministers who are now in the backbenches. And the news has come out that the leader of the Conservatives in Scotland, a very popular figure, Ruth Davidson, has quit. She made the announcement in which she said she was still confident, however, that Boris Johnson wasn't really prepared to leave the EU without a deal.
I stared him right in the eye. I asked him outright, "Look, I need to know, are you actually trying to get a deal or not?" And he categorically assured me that he was. So I want him to get that deal. I believe that's what he and his government are working towards, and I support him in that effort.
I think her words will have been quite a relief to Boris Johnson and his supporters. I mean, let's just wind back for a moment, because Ruth Davidson is a very unusual figure. Scottish Conservatives have a traditional image as quite a sort of tweedy, golfing, grouse moor hunting, shooting, fishing lot. But she's young, she's female, urban, gay and very, very personable. She's credited with an amazing turnaround in Scottish Conservative fortune. And she's very much opposed Boris Johnson in the Brexit campaign. She was on the other side arguing for the UK to remain in the EU. And some have linked her decision to resign to this news that Parliament will be suspended. But she says her decision is largely personal. She had a baby with her partner earlier this year and that has played a big part in her decision. And she didn't therefore use this speech to set off a missile under him, which is what some of them had feared she would do and become a rallying point for Conservatives who are opposed to him.
But is there a warning in this for him in some way?
He will know that there is a warning. She has been quite outspoken that Boris Johnson isn't quite her cup of tea in the past. And I think it will be clear that he's rather on borrowed time with her, that she has given her support, that he's got to get that deal. But if he doesn't get the deal, if he goes for no deal, I think the situation will be very different.
Susan Hulme. The government of Yemen has accused the UAE, a key part of the coalition that's been fighting on its behalf, of launching airstrikes against its troops. The accusation comes after reports that a number of government soldiers have been killed by an airstrike reportedly carried out by the UAE. On Wednesday, the Yemeni government announced that it had retaken control of the southern city of Aden. Subsequently, southern separatists backed by the UAE were quick to announce that they, in fact, were back in command of Aden. Ramzi Shuaibi is the president of the Southern Transitional Council, as the separatists call themselves.
Today we tell them that the south is a cemetery for the invaders. We are speaking to you from the trenches, not from hotels. Our heroes are on the front lines and occupy them, and the victories are coming one after the other.
The Yemeni government has meanwhile urged Saudi Arabia to intervene on its behalf. A written statement issued read, in part,
"We hold the UAE fully responsible for this blatant assault, which is inconsistent with law and international legal instruments. We appeal to the brotherly kingdom of Saudi Arabia and its wise leadership as the leader of the coalition to support legitimacy in Yemen and to stand by the legitimate government and stop this illegal and unjustified military escalation."
So what do we know for sure about these airstrikes and who carried them out? Iona Craig is a journalist who specialises on Yemen.
Certainly from the statements that have come out from the Yemeni government, they've laid the blame squarely at the United Arab Emirates. And they've accused them of killing and injuring both Yemeni government forces as well as civilians without giving any numbers. People I've spoken to in Aden over the last 24 hours, they've heard airstrikes. All indications are that it was the UAE and they were carrying out those airstrikes in support of their proxy forces, who are the southern separatists, against the Yemeni government led by President Hadi. So these are two elements of what are supposed to be a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, who are now fighting each other heavily to the east of the city of Aden today.
It seems as if it is a significant development that Saudi-led coalition that we've been talking about for so long appears to be fracturing. How are you reading it?
Well, they've been fracturing for some time. It's just that the crack has suddenly got a lot wider in the last 3 weeks. And they have fought before. So the southern separatist forces who the UAE actually created and fund and trained have clashed with the Yemeni government before, led by President Hadi and the troops that are loyal to him, who are very much aligned to the Islah political party, Yemen's political party that encompasses the Muslim Brotherhood. But it has never escalated to this kind of level.
Just in terms of the UAE and its motives, if it were behind these attacks. Now, they have been backing these southern separatists for a while, as you mentioned. Is it, in a sense, because they feel that these separatists are useful or that they maybe ideologically support their cause? Or is it something to do with what you were mentioning about the fact that the Yemeni government has been using as part of its proxy forces a group that are allied to the Muslim Brotherhood, which itself is a movement that the UAE have big problems with?
Yes, I mean, really, for the UAE, their problem is with Islah. Islah have politically aligned themselves to President Hadi, and there are military units that are essentially the military wing, if you like, of that party. But Islah is classified as a terrorist organisation in the United Arab Emirates itself, where they have a branch, and are seen by the UAE as a potential existential threat to their country. And in fact, for them, really, empowering them is more of a threat than even the Houthis, who they've all been fighting now since 2015.
In terms of Saudi Arabia, given the closeness that there's been between Saudi and the UAE strategically, I mean, not just in Yemen, but in so many policy areas and regional areas in recent years, how big a deal do you think this is, and how much pressure do you think Saudi will now feel from the Yemeni government in some sense to come down hard on the UAE?
It's going to be very difficult for Saudi Arabia. I mean, even when the separatists backed by the UAE took control of Aden originally back on the 10th of August, even then, although the Saudis called for dialogue between the two sides, they weren't as strongly against what the southern separatists, or in the statements that they released, and they could have been. I mean, it would seem slightly crazy now if Saudi Arabia was forced to carry out airstrikes in support of the Hadi government, because that would essentially put them in a proxy conflict with the UAE. And I really can't see that happening, although there may be a division in their goals and what they want to do between Saudi Arabia and the UAE in Yemen. I think obviously them going into a proxy conflict themselves in Yemen would be pretty astounding, and I think very unlikely. So really, it's now going to be down to Saudi Arabia to try and start a process of dialogue, which they tried to do earlier this month and failed.
Iona Craig talking to the BBC's Tim Franks. 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy is a podcast which tells the fascinating stories of inventions, ideas, and innovations. The tale of how a disgruntled postal service customer changed the world with the invention of the stamp. The bloody and tumultuous history of rubber. And what may have just started it all for the human economy. Fire. If that sparks your interest, just search for 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy wherever you found this podcast. Still to come on Global News.
He's a young guy, you know, he can be quite hot-headed, but that certainly does not mean that he can be imprisoned at will.
The Russian student facing 8 years in prison after protesting against President Putin. Our understanding of genetics is telling us ever more about ourselves,
But sometimes also the absence of genetic evidence can be significant, and that seems to be the outcome of a major new study of the genetic records of almost 500,000 people, which concludes that while there is evidence of genome signature for same-sex sexual behavior, there's no such thing as a single gay gene, as Professor Melinda Mills of Oxford University told the BBC's Tim Franks.
This study was interesting. It was engaged in by a group from MIT and Cambridge and many others. And what they found is we knew for a long time that same-sex behavior and orientation seemed to run in families and that there was a biological component. And as you just said, you know, there was a finding in the 1990s that there was this gay gene on the X chromosome. And until now, we knew little about the genetic or biological basis of this behavior. And these studies in the 90s were often quite small, on a handful of, 100 families, and almost exclusively on gay men. So I think what this study does until now, it's really the largest study that we've ever seen in this area. It's almost 500,000 people, and they replicated on many different data sets. And I guess what I find really interesting about this study is it's actually the first one to really show that there's an upper ceiling of what we could probably predict from genetics, which is around 8 to 25%, which certainly isn't an absence. And then they isolated actually 5 genetic loci that were related to same-sex sexual behavior and looked at their biological function. Now, together, those predicted around 1%. So, you know, that's the main finding of what they found.
Gosh, I mean, 1%, so almost insignificant.
Well, not necessarily. So you have to imagine that what they could do. So there's 2 different techniques that they used. One is what's called a GWAS, a genome-wide association search, where they looked across the entire genome. But what they also did was they calculated genetic heritability in another way, so this prediction. And they found actually that they could eventually probably predict up to 25%. So why would they have this difference? Well, what they're picking up with the second technique is things that are rare on the genome and what we call non-additive. So they're picking up a lot more resolution and information. So probably the 1% we're guessing is an underestimation. And eventually, as we look at more data and we develop more techniques and ways of looking at the genome, they're showing that the upper ceiling could be much higher.
For those who want to discriminate against gay and lesbian people, how far is there a danger that they might interpret this survey as saying, well, it's a lifestyle choice, that people do not have their sexuality predetermined, and therefore it's a behavior they can unlearn?
Right. So, you know, this is something that often comes up when we're looking at this sort of complex behavioral sort of outcomes when we're looking with genetics. And I think there's this tendency for people to almost long for some sort of genetic determinism or hard truth, you know, to say, okay, something must be genetic. And this study actually shows that this is in some ways a biologically and genetically behavior. So this could actually reduce discrimination and help people within the community. But I guess as you allude to on the other side, you know, with the techniques that we have now and what they've found, if you can predict less than 1%, it's certainly not something that you'd be able to use, you know, for individual tests. And I think that's what people get worried about. So they think, well, could this be used as a tool for interventions or some sort of supposed cure? Or could it be used for embryo selection, genetic discrimination by employers or insurers, or even, you know, you can think of commercial uses such as tests. So the authors unequivocally say, and we know that, you know, from this, that you could not use this as a test in any of those ways. But it's rather just an opening and a start to broaden our understanding of the biological and genetic basis of sexuality.
Professor Melinda Mills. This weekend, opposition activists are expected to take to Moscow's streets again, the latest in a wave of mass protests over the authorities' refusal to allow anti-Kremlin candidates to register for a local election. Students from top universities in the city have played a key part in the rallies, with many getting detained and 3 now facing serious criminal charges. But that tough response to the protests has mobilized students further, as our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
Moscow's appeal court has never seen anything like it. Crowds of students in tattoos and T-shirts pouring through its doors and packing its corridors. They've turned out for Yegor Zhukov, a politics student who's facing 8 years in prison after this summer's opposition protests. Yegor runs a popular blog that's full of talk of Russia as authoritarian and of Vladimir Putin as a tyrant. The 21-year-old is one of three students now charged with rioting, even though the only real violence at the protests came from police.
You know, I lived in London for a long time. I know what riots actually are. I've seen them firsthand.
Shock at the charge brought even a rapper to court. Oxymiron, who once studied medieval English at Oxford, came offering bail for Yegor.
He just said a lot of things that, annoyed a lot of people. I mean, he's a young guy, you know, he can be quite hot-headed, but that certainly does not mean that he can be imprisoned at will.
That's what the students fear is happening in an attempt to scare people off the streets. They've been on the front line of the protests that began in Moscow when opposition candidates were barred from a city election. Hundreds were detained, some beaten by police and others fined. But that's only galvanized many students into further action. In the back of a cafe, a group huddle over their laptops, discussing the hottest issue of the day. The team at Doxa Student Journal are actively covering the protests, reporting from the streets and from the courts. Many are from the same college as Yegor Zhukov. Several tell me they were arrested briefly themselves.
I was detained during first day of protest, and even a lot of my friends and just different people who were not really political, they started being political because students are participating, students are put into jail.
We have the new generation that grew up with different kind of values, wanting some freedom or democracy or some basic stuff. And, like, me personally, I'm thinking that now students are finally becoming some kind of, like, social force that can change something.
At the appeals court, only a handful of students actually made it into the room for Yegor Zhukov's hearing. He appeared on a video link from his remand centre, standing and referring respectfully to the judge as Your Honour. But when the time came for his final speech, it was like he was recording his blog. I don't know whether I'll be freed, the student prisoner concluded, but Russia certainly will be. In the corridor outside, that defiance spread through the young crowd, following on their phones.
It was quite a strong speech you made, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it was a nice speech and it's pretty similar to his YouTube blog.
That was Arman. Alexander actually thinks getting arrested has its upside.
So I can say about YouTube blog, before he was arrested, it was nearly 103,000 subscribers. Within 10 days, it reached 120,000 with no videos on channel.
And their cause isn't fading. Yegor's appeal against arrest was rejected. The young student remains behind bars.
Sarah Rainsford. A new device aimed at preventing sexual assault on public transport has been launched in Japan. The firm Shachihata announced in May it would develop the app after discussions on social media on how to stop groping. I spoke to Josh Haig from the BBC's technology desk about how the device works.
So it works by allows victims to mark their sense with invisible ink. That can be seen under UV light, so it can't be seen by the naked eye. But then a would-be victim can then identify someone that's already attacked someone else by shining the light on their hand and seeing the stamp. And that way they can avoid being attacked in the future.
So they would have to carry around this device.
Exactly.
We've all seen these stamps perhaps at a nightclub or theme park or something where you then it shows under this particular light. So they'd have to carry a kind of reader for this?
The stamp has a UV light inside it. It's sort of the size of your index finger, so it's not very big and you can carry that around in your pocket.
So what sparked interest in this type of a device in Japan?
It was a viral video earlier this year that showed Japanese schoolgirls chasing down a suspected groper. At the end of the video, the man fell over. He was tripped up by a fellow commuter who saw what was happening and tried to stop it.
What's the reaction been to this in Japan?
It sold out within half an hour. There were only 500 of them on sale, but it sold out almost immediately. The creators haven't said that they're making any more, but the reaction online has been very positive toward it. So people have been asking for more to be made. So We're not sure what's going to happen there, but I'm assuming more will be made in the future. In terms of concerns, people have voiced their concerns online, but developers haven't actually addressed those. So there's definitely scope for it to be misused, but that's not been spoken about at all.
Have you spoken to anyone about it that's expressed any concern?
We spoke to Rape Crisis England and Wales. They were concerned that the device could be misused, that it was concerning that people are monetizing anti-rape tech in the first place because it places the onus on the victim to stop the attacks from happening.
And this all came from Japan. So how prevalent are these types of sexual crimes in Japan?
It's a huge problem there. In 2017, I think there were almost 2,000 groping reports. In 2009, they installed anti-groping cameras on commuter trains in Tokyo. And earlier this year, it was an app launched that a victim can use in order to display a message saying that they need help.
Josh Haig. Here in the UK, a man has been fined and had his license sanctioned for driving a car with another car strapped to its roof. Glyndwr Wyn Richards was seen driving the vehicle in Wales in March. Our correspondent, Sean Lloyd, takes up the story.
The extraordinary footage caught on a security camera at an industrial estate in Aberystwyth shows a Volkswagen Passat being driven with another car teetering on its rooftop. Glyndwr Wyn Richards was taking a Skoda Octavia to a scrapyard, but instead of towing the unwanted vehicle, he decided to transport it on the roof of his car. At one point, he can be seen parking up his own version of a double-decker before calmly strolling into a building. He then returns without batting an eyelid and gets back behind the wheel. Richards reportedly told Aberystwyth Magistrates Court that he recognised that strapping a car to the top of another had been a stupid thing to do, but insisted there'd be no danger of it falling off. The 51-year-old was fined £195, but avoided a ban after pleading guilty to using a vehicle with a load likely to cause danger or injury.
Sean Lloyd, but the unanswered question remains, how did the car get up there? Well, you help us figure it out because we haven't figured it out yet. But that's all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.